Welcome back to the program. The current financial crisis may have put capitalism under siege and highlighted the tensions between successful capitalism and American democracy. Yet this is not the first time these forces have been at odds. The decades after the Civil War and the birth of the Industrial Revolution created massive industries as we moved from an agrarian economy to a highly capitalistic one, one that some thought at the time would overpower democracy itself. This period, often known as the Gilded Age, is both a fascinating story in its own right and has profound implications for many of the issues we face today. We're going to take a look at this with a guest that has been with us numerous times before. It is always a pleasure to have H.W. Brands back on the program. H.W. Brands is the Dixon Allen Anderson Professor of History at the University of Texas at Austin. He was twice a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for his biographies of Benjamin Franklin and for his best-selling book about FDR, Traitor to His Class. It is my pleasure to have H.W. Brands back on the program to talk about his newest work, American Colossus, The Triumph of Capitalism, 1865 to 1900. H.W. Brands, welcome to the program.
Always good to talk to you, Jeff.
Good to have you here. When we look at capitalism, talk a little bit first about how it was viewed in this country prior to the Industrial Revolution. How did we look at the capitalist enterprise before the massive industries that grew up after the Civil War?
Well, as a matter of fact, capitalism really didn't exist in the United States before the Industrial Revolution. At least, it didn't exist in any recognizable form, recognizable today. There were individual proprietorships. There were small partnerships. But the institutions and values that we've come to associate with capitalism didn't exist. For example, corporations hardly existed before about the middle of the 19th century. There were individual corporations that were chartered individually by state legislatures. They were given limited duration. You might have a charter for 10 years or 20 years. They were often designed to be monopolies, but they were akin to public utilities. For example, somebody would be given a charter to operate a ferry between New Jersey and New York City, and it would be an exclusive right. It would be something that would be limited for maybe 20 years. But the idea that pretty much anybody could start up a corporation, it just didn't exist. Banks didn't exist before the 19th century. It's the rise of modern capitalism is part and parcel of the American industrialization process. There wouldn't have been modern capitalism without industrialization, and there wouldn't have been industrialization without the institutions of capitalism.
And it's interesting because it's so much of the rhetoric about capitalism and defense of capitalism today, one would come away with the impression, at least from the rhetoric, that somehow it was tied to the very founding of the Republic, that democratic capitalism was as much a part of the American DNA as democracy itself.
Well, I like to say that the two charters of modern American institutions were both written in 1776, or at least published in 1776. These were Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, which became the blueprint for democracy, and Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, which became something of the blueprint for capitalism. But in 1776, neither democracy nor capitalism existed. In fact, until the early part of the 19th century, neither one existed. By the end of the 19th century, both existed and were practiced in the United States. So there is a lag between when the ideas were established and when the practices actually came into effect.
And talk a little bit about what happened as this transformation took place to the industrial age. And it was a triumph both of the need for industrialization as well as individuals who you spotlight in the book, who really took advantage of this.
The capitalist revolution in America, as I call it, as I call these series of events that occurred in the latter half of the 19th century, were a combination of institutional developments, new techniques, new technologies, and the actions of very many individuals. But all of these transformed a society that had been based on agrarian values and agrarian economics, that had been based on small-scale and face-to-face dealings, transformed this into a society where more and more people, eventually most people, would make their living in industry, would no longer work for themselves, but would work for somebody else, would live not on farms, but in cities. And who would deal with the world before them in an increasingly faceless way? In 1810, if you wanted to have some meat on the table for dinner. You'd go to the corner butcher. You knew the butcher. You probably saw the cow getting slaughtered. By 1900, if you wanted to get meat on the table, you would probably buy something from one of the big packing houses in Chicago. You would have no idea where the meat came from. You would have no idea what went into it, and you would buy it from a massive corporation. There was this sense that the scale of American life was changing. Some people found this exciting. Some people, and for many people, there was a great opportunity in this. Many people found it unnerving.
Talk about those that found it unnerving, those that really had trouble dealing with this dramatic change.
The capitalism that emerged in America during the late 19th century was enormously successful in lifting the average standard of living. By 1900, Americans lived better on average, and this is important, on average, than any people had ever lived at any other time in history. But those averages masked growing inequalities, so that along with the very rich, there were the very poor. And the very poor were more visible than they had ever been. Poverty had been a feature of human life for thousands and thousands of years. But in an agrarian age, poverty was often hidden on the farm, out of the way in the countryside. In America's big cities, poverty existed cheek by jowl with the mansions of the rich. So a stone's throw from William Vanderbilt's mansion in Midtown Manhattan were some of the worst slums of the Lower East Side. People became to see this, and it became more visible, and they asked themselves, is a higher standard of living the only value that American society wants to pursue? Whatever happened to equality?
And talk a little bit about how that question was answered, but also the fact that as capitalism grew, as industrialization grew, they were inherently winners and losers within that system.
There were winners and losers. There had always been winners and losers. People understood that not everybody is born with equal talents. But during the Industrial Age and during this period of the capitalist revolution, the differences became magnified. So the wealthiest person in George Washington's Virginia lived a life that was not that different from a poor, relatively poor yeoman farmer in Virginia. But the lifestyle of the Vanderbilts and the Astors and the wealthy folks in New York was worlds apart from the lifestyle of those people who lived in the slums of the Lower East Side. And there were a lot of people who said, this is not the way this is supposed to be. In America, there are two principal institutions that characterize American society, democracy and capitalism. Capitalism rewards inequality. Capitalism is driven by inequality, and the inequalities tend to be aggravated over time. Democracy is based on the principle of equality, and a lot of people asked if capitalism and democracy could coexist and began to have serious doubts about that possibility.
And, of course, many of these principles of the Gilded Age, people that you write about like J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller and Carnegie, and many of their compatriots became sort of aspirational figures for so many people. Talk about that.
One of the striking things about American history is the relative, in fact, almost complete absence of class-based resentment. There have been very few occasions in American history when people of the working class say, nobody should be rich like that. Nobody should be as rich as Andrew Carnegie. Because there has long been a belief, maybe it's part of the mythology of America, that maybe I could be that rich, or maybe my children could be that rich. And so, in this case, the existence of these great fortunes was, as you suggest, a source of aspiration for many people. And especially if you looked at somebody like Carnegie or John Rockefeller. Carnegie came to America penniless as an immigrant when he was 12 years old from Scotland. John D. Rockefeller came from a very modest background, and they became captains of industry. And when people looked at them, they said, well, if Carnegie can do it, maybe I can do it. And as long as the opportunities exist, as long as there were examples of people who rose from rags to riches, the idea that somehow this country had developed into closed-off classes, that never took hold. The socialist movement really never gained any traction in the
United
States.
And that really was the striking difference between the Industrial Revolution and what it produced in America versus the rest of the West.
Yeah, and it's a little bit hard to tell whether it was because of the way capitalism emerged in the different countries or, and I think this is a more likely explanation, in France, in England, in Germany, there were pre-existing class structures. And so the Industrial Revolution took place within this background of deference of one class to another. There never was that kind of deference in America. And in part because of that, American capitalism tended to be more dynamic than capitalism elsewhere. And if you got rich in America, you were just as good as somebody who had had wealth for a long time. The idea of the nouveau riche, that's a French term that never really had that much hold in America. Rich was rich, whether you got it in this generation or 20 generations ago.
As we talked about at the outset, this was in the aftermath. This really began in the aftermath of the Civil War. How did race play a role as these changes were taking place?
One of the striking consequences of the Civil War was the emancipation of 4 million former slaves. And what this meant was that the South, which had largely existed apart from the national capitalist economy, because it was based not on a cash economy, but on an economy where labor was coerced, the South had to be integrated into the national economy. In fact, one of the big parts of the story that I tell in the book is that this emergence of a capitalist system was partly a story of the big industrial cities of the East and Midwest, but equally it was about extending the reach of modern capitalism across the country into the South, which all of a sudden has to figure out how to develop an economy based on cash rather than on coercion. It spread across the West, where there were natural resources that had to be mobilized, or at least were mobilized and exploited, for the development of the country as a whole.
How did this play out in the political landscape of the time?
During the late 19th century, I think it's probably fair to say that the capitalist sector of American society had claim on the best talent. Politics fell into some kind of disrepute. Now, this was partly as a result, a bit of a backlash from all the effort that had gone into politics during the sectional crisis of the 1850s and the Civil War of the 1860s and Reconstruction of the 1870s. By the late 1870s, Americans were pretty exhausted politically. They had invested so much time and effort into making these political changes. And a whole lot of people felt, as some people would feel, as Warren Harding would articulate after the First World War, Americans wanted to get back to normalcy. And his successor, Calvin Coolidge, would say the business of America is business. And so people like Andrew Carnegie didn't think about going into politics. They went into business. And I think it's fair to say that the greatest talent went into business. Well, the result of this was, there will always be elected officials, but the elected officials were not, generally speaking, of the highest caliber. And furthermore, they tended to take, I won't say their marching orders exactly, but they tended to be considerably influenced by the capitalist sector. And so that was a time when there were essentially no regulations regarding who could give to political campaigns. And in 1896, when Mark Hanna was organizing the campaign of William McKinley, he went from Wall Street bank to Wall Street bank, essentially shaking down the corporate captains and saying, okay, you need to pony up the money to make sure McKinley gets elected, because if he doesn't, William Jennings Bryan is going to bring the deluge. And so money talked in American politics as it had never talked before. The U.S. Senate became known as the Millionaires Club because, roughly speaking, that was what it cost to buy a seat in the Senate.
Part of what was taking place also was a huge demographic shift from the rural areas to the cities.
There was a huge shift, what historians and sociologists call in-migration, people moving from the farms to the cities. At the same time, there was a huge immigration from foreign countries to the United States. Both of these demographic streams were essential to the industrialization process, because the secret of industrialization was allowing unskilled workers to operate machines that could produce the products of industry. People had been making stuff for hundreds of years, but you had to be a skilled blacksmith, for example, to make much in the way of iron or steel products in 1800. By 1900, you didn't have to have skills at all. You could operate machines that would do it. And it was the pool of labor that came into industry, into the industrial cities, that made this possible. And it's worth noting, given the context today of the debate over immigration, that that was a time when immigration to the United States was largely unregulated. There was one important exception. In 1882, Congress passed something called the Chinese Exclusion Act, which banned Chinese laborers, and that was largely at the behest of the California Working Men's Party. But for the most part, the doors were wide open, and this reflected the desires of the owners of these industries, because they wanted as many hands as possible, knowing that if these immigrants came in, they would make it very difficult for workers to organize and drive wages up.
And where was the pushback at the time, in a sense of those that perhaps wanted to go back or desired a simpler time, a more Jeffersonian model?
The pushback came from two directions. There were the intellectuals who felt that American society was coarsened by what seemed to them this mad dash for wealth. These were often people who had had substantial positions or who had held distinguished posts or been from distinguished families in previous generations and found themselves somehow bypassed. Henry Adams was a good example of this. He came from the Adams family of John Adams and John Quincy Adams. But Henry Adams looked on industrialization as marking a decline in civilization. And he was always scratching his head at how somehow the American people had lost the ability to identify sensitivity and talent, namely him. The second stream of opposition came from farmers who believed that they were being bypassed as well. Farmers had been told by Thomas Jefferson that they were the salt of the earth and that American democracy, the American experiment in republican government, depended on a strong yeoman class. By 1870, they found themselves bypassed. They also found themselves squeezed by economic forces beyond their control. One of the things that happened starting in the mid-1870s was a persistent deflation. Prices for manufactured, but especially for farm products, went down for a period of about 20 years. And farmers found themselves more and more burdened by debt. And they interpreted this as what happened when a country industrialized. And so they insisted on regaining, or at least on trying to regain control of the political economy. They organized first in something called the Farmers' Alliance and then in the Populist Party. And the Populist Party came along in the 1890s and proposed important measures that would have reined in the modern capitalist system, antitrust measures, regulation of railroads, and such things, to reassert the principle that this country is a democracy before it is a capitalist society.
As you were working on this, how profound was it to look at some of these pressures and issues that we've been discussing and see how profound those parallels are to the transitions that are taking place today?
One of the striking things was a reminder that capitalism, as I mentioned earlier, is a terrific engine for raising the overall GDP. If the only goal of American society is to make the gross domestic product as large as possible, then let capitalism go more or less unchecked. However, there are some caveats here. One is, if you do this, you will almost certainly have to put up with growing inequality. It's in the nature of capitalism that inequalities tend to become aggravated. And secondly, you will have to accept a certain amount of instability, because capitalism, when operating essentially unfettered, drives itself into these moments of crisis. In the 19th century, they were called panics. There was a panic of 1857, a panic of 1873, a panic of 1893. When the financial world seizes up, just as it did, in the fall of 2008. Now, in the 19th century, the panics were becoming increasingly national in scope. They weren't yet global in the way they would be in the beginning of the 21st century. But these are some of the side effects of capitalism. And looking back historically, it's hard to see how they can be eliminated from capitalism entirely unless the government steps in. But when the government steps in, then you lose some of the exuberance of capitalism that makes it such an engine for overall growth.
Of course, the other thing that came along with it were tremendous excesses that were most clearly evident in what we refer to as the kind of Gilded Age.
For the first time in American life, the idea of spending for the sake of spending became, I won't say accepted practice, but when people had lots of money, they wanted to show it off. In an earlier time, there were wealthy people, but in America, there had never been anything like the chateaus of France, and because there had never been the nobility, the people who had all of this money to spend and nothing much better to spend it on. Interestingly, the palaces of Gilded Age Newport and of Asheville and places like that, these were built not by the original builders of the fortune, by and large, but they were built by the children, the ones who inherited all this money and almost had nothing better to do. Cornelius Vanderbilt was the one who built the fortune on which the Breakers and the other big mansions of his children were based. Cornelius Vanderbilt didn't indulge himself that way. He had a few pleasures. He loved to drive horses fast, and so he had the finest carriage in New York and the best team of horses. But he would have considered it either superfluous or perhaps offensive and downright wrong-headed to waste money on frills like that. But he was long gone, and his children inherited the money, and they did build these lavish mansions.
And while this gave huge opportunity to unskilled labor, as you talked about before, seeing this excess and seeing the growth gave rise to what would become the union movement.
The union movement was an outgrowth of the emergence of a working class. Before the Industrial Revolution, before the period I describe in the book, there was no working class in America. Farmers, of course, existed, and farmers tended to work for themselves. Occasionally and for brief periods, people would work for other people, but it was usually seen as a transition experience. Sometimes an agricultural worker would hire out, hoping to save enough to buy his own farm. Young women began to work in the textile mills of New England, but that was for a year or two before they would get married. By 1870 and 1880, it became clear that there were workers who would always be workers, who would never own anything, and they became reconciled to this existence. And as they began to identify themselves as workers, then they began to think in terms of class solidarity. So the railroads, for example, were the companies, this was the industry that witnessed the early examples of labor organizing. But the disputes between workers and management were bitter almost from the beginning, because the managers, the owners, thought that labor unions were, by their nature, illegitimate, that workers should deal with the owners one by one, as workers had dealt with owners one by one from the 18th century. The trouble was, of course, that any kind of negotiation was utterly unfair, or certainly was asymmetrical, because the owner of one of these large railroads had a great deal of economic leverage that individual workers didn't have. And so one of the results of this was a bitter, violent series of labor strikes between the late 1870s and the early 1890s. In some of these, starting the railroad strike of 1877, the entire transportation network of the United States was paralyzed. Hundreds of people were killed.
How did this play out in America's relationships with the rest of the world?
Until the late 19th century, until, in fact, the late 1890s, most Americans felt that their dealings with the world beyond American shores should be intermittent and indirect. Americans essentially believed that God had created the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean to insulate the United States from the affairs of other countries. By the late 1890s, however, Americans in increasing numbers began to look to the rest of the world to resolve some problems that were emerging in American society. There was a deep industrial depression during the 1890s, and people began to ask themselves if American consumers would ever be able to purchase all that American factories could produce. And when they asked this question, some said, well, maybe not, but what we'll need to do then is to find foreign customers for the amount of goods that we can produce. Americans began to look abroad during this age of imperialism at the actions of other countries. America's principal economic competitors in the 1890s were Britain, France, and Germany. All three of those countries had extensive overseas empires. And Americans looked at this and they said, well, okay, if it works for the British and the French and the Germans, maybe it should work for us. And so for the first time, in fact, for the only time in its history, the United States at the very end of the 1890s embarked on a career of formal imperialism. At the end of the Spanish-American War, the United States annexed the Philippines and Puerto Rico and claimed a protectorate over Cuba, essentially telling the world America has now arrived on the global stage. And in fact, it's been on the global stage ever since. In this regard, it's this period that begins the long phase that continues until now with American armies in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Talk a little bit about what was going on in terms of a populist sentiment at the time.
Well, the populace organized farmers into a movement to dispute the primacy of the capitalists in governing the country. And although it didn't rise to a class-based movement, which is one of the ways that the term populism is often understood, it was still, well, it was more than anything, farms against cities, farms against industry. But it began to shade into this idea that it's the ordinary people of the country, maybe the poor people of the country, or at least maybe not the urban poor, because so many of them are immigrants, and we're not quite sure about them yet. But farmers who are having a hard time, these are really the repository of true American values. And it's during this period that for the first time in its way, this notion that the heartland of America is where America's true and traditional values reside comes to the center of the political stage.
Well, an economic elite rose during this period. Some of the people we've talked about, Morgan and Rockefellers and Carnegie, etc. Was there an intellectual elite that was emerging at the time, and where did they fit into the equation?
Well, there were people who thought there ought to be an intellectual elite and considered themselves members of an intellectual elite, but very few people outside their small circle listened to them. And in fact, many of them were quite concerned that American society was going downhill. Whatever the American economy was doing, the United States was losing what it once had claimed in terms of civilization. And so there were people, Henry James, William James, Henry Adams, John Hay, people like this, who would get together every so often and commiserate on how it was that the country wasn't following their wise counsel. But outside their group, most people paid very little attention. If they paid attention to intellectuals at all, it was to intellectuals like Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, who wrote literature that highlighted and celebrated the very ordinary American experience and who hearkened back to an earlier time. And so Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer, these are stories from an earlier age. But they certainly aren't stories of intellectual classes or anything that might call itself an intellectual elite.
But yet, concurrent with the growth of the working class was a growing system of kind of mass education, particularly focused on the children of the working class.
One of the things that Americans decided by the late 19th century was that this country was wealthy enough that it could afford to educate its young people. The idea of public education had been around for many decades, but it became a reality in the latter part of the 19th century. In part, it was an economic thing. So well-educated children will become productive workers. At least equally, it was a way of acculturating and assimilating these large numbers of immigrants. When immigrants came to the United States from foreign countries, they often didn't speak English. And they brought children over who didn't speak English either, but who would be educated in these schools where they might then learn to speak English and become good Americans. Then, as now, public schools were institutions not simply to educate people, but to acculturate people, and especially for the new arrivals from foreign countries.
What are the parallels that you see today as we move from this industrial economy, as we've been moving towards more of an information-based economy, a brain power economy, dealing with issues of immigration again, dealing with this tension between democracy and capitalism? Talk a little about that.
One of the things that happened in the 19th century was that a pendulum, if you want to use the image, swung from the direction of democracy in the direction of capitalism in the late 19th century. So the early 19th century was an era when the institutions and values of democracy took hold. And the principles of democracy were what really drove American life about 1850. By 1900, the pendulum had swung more in the direction of capitalism. And so the second half of the 19th century was an age in which the institutions and values of capitalism took hold. In the early 20th century, the pendulum began moving back during the Progressive Era, the New Deal of the 1930s. Democracy reasserted its primacy over capitalism. With the Reagan years, the Reagan Revolution of the 1980s and the latter part of the 20th century, the pendulum began swinging back in the direction of capitalism. Now, it's hard to tell where we are right now. With the crisis of 2008 and the continuing recession, there's a possibility that things will begin to shift back in the direction of a greater reassertion of the principles of democracy and an insistence on greater equality. But it's a little bit too soon to tell whether that's actually happening or whether it's going to be delayed a while longer. But there does seem to be this back and forth in American life. Americans value democracy and the basic value of equality. They also value capitalism and the desire for economic growth. The two have existed in tension for a long time. I expect that the tension will continue, and this pendulum will go back and forth probably for decades to come.
H.W. Brands, the book is American Colossus, The Triumph of Capitalism, 1865 to 1900. Bill, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure, Jeff.
Take care. Thank you.